I believe remote sensing is still also very, very important. So eventually, we still need the remote sensing technology to improve the throughput. So I think either some of the proximal sensing signals could be transferred to be implemented for remote sensing, or I think sometimes the remote sensing and the proximal sensors should collaborate together. We can combine them as a solution. So you take an image of the whole region, and then you get the variance, the idea of the variance, and then you can send those proximal sensors to check some of the points of the locations to get the very detailed, accurate information, and then fuse the remote sensing and the proximal sensing together. So I foresee that could be the mode of the future to achieve high throughput and high accuracy at the same time.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor of Integrative Precision Ag at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Jan Jin. He's an Associate Professor at Purdue University and President of LeaseSpec LLC. Jen, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. I'm really excited to have you here with us today, and we're going to be talking about nitrogen and sensors, so that's super exciting for me especially. And just to get us started, can you share with us a little bit about your background and what was the path that you took until getting to your position?
Yeah, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It is really my honor to be here to talk with you. So I originally was from China, and I got my initial education background from computer science and computer engineering. So basically computer science as a bachelor's degree, and then I traveled to Denmark Technical University in Copenhagen. And I got my master's degree in computer engineering. And then I did some switch from computer science, computer engineering to agriculture engineering. So I joined Iowa State University, the agriculture and biosystems engineering department. Got my PhD from agriculture engineering. So after that, I started working. So my first job was with DuPont Pioneer. The company's name currently is Corteva, so it's one of the two biggest breeding companies in this nation. So I used to be the research scientist, and then my title changed to the technical leader in the company. So when I worked for Corteva, my role is to be in charge of the phenotyping sensors, helping with screening the crops to support the breeding programs inside the company. So I worked for Corteva for 5 years until 10 years ago in 2015. I switched back to academia and started my faculty position at Purdue University. So that's a short resume.
That's awesome. that's really impressive. I think it's very interesting, you know, all the different places you've been, different experiences, academia and industry. It's really, really exciting to see that. And I'll keep my excitement to some of the questions that come after, but I'm really happy about this episode with you. All right. So can you tell us a little bit about your research program at Purdue University? What have you been studying, and what are some of the cool projects you have going on?
Yeah. So here at Purdue, I'm an engineer. So maybe a little more background about my department, agriculture and biological engineering department. So our department is the overlapping part between the College of Agriculture and College of Engineering. So sitting here, we need to be a little bit knowledge on both sides, right? So we are engineers, but we apply engineering skills to serve the agriculture users. So for my lab, my lab here is named Plant Sensor Lab. So what we do here is to develop advanced plant phenotyping sensors, mostly imaging-based sensors, to help to phenotype the crops or the other plants so that we can help people to quickly scan the plant and then get the answers about the nutrition status, the disease symptoms, and also the maybe the chemical damages on the crops. So imagine something like a magic wand that you swing through the leaf surface, and then on your smartphone, you can read everything about the health status of the plants. So in our lab, we do both hardware and software development, how to design the easy to use, very accurate imaging sensors, and then how to develop the advanced AI software algorithms, models to process the images so we can get the answers to the farmers and the researchers.
That's awesome. So I want to follow that up and ask you if you could explain to us a little bit more about these phenotyping sensors that you're developing. So you mentioned optical sensors, right? Can you tell us a little bit more about how does that technology work? More specifically, what type of optical sensors you're using? And you mentioned some of the stresses already, like nutrient diseases. You know, so if you can expand about that, both on the sensor side, what it is, and how does it work to be able to detect, you know, so many different types of stressors?
Yeah, so sure. So our goal is to develop the next generation phenotyping sensors so we can provide more accurate and higher throughput sensors compared with human being. So, you know, we have 100 million acres of the cornfield in North America. And our farmers have been using their own eyes to kind of take a look, investigating their fields, and basically have an assessment of how much nitrogen is in the field, because they need to decide whether or not they need to fertilize again and how much fertilization to put into the field, right? So people used to do that with their own eyes. But compared with the human eyes, which can only see three colors, now we have advanced imaging technologies such as multispectral, hyperspectral imaging technologies, which can see hundreds of colors compared with just RGB three colors of the human eyes. So since we have these advanced imaging technologies, our vision capability is kind of expanded. So we can see more, we can see more accurately. And at the same time, we have advanced AI technologies now. So we're not only replacing the human eyes, but also trying to replace the human brain as well. So how can we use the sensor to take the better images and then use the supercomputing powers to process those images so we can get very accurate measurements to have the assessment of the nutrition disease and the chemical damages, things like that. So I just mentioned multispectral, hyperspectral imaging technologies. So we have a lot of the other very interesting imaging technologies, such as fluorescence imaging for, you know, mostly photosynthesis efficiency measurement. We have the RGB, which is easy to use. People have RGB cameras in their own pockets. And also we have thermal imaging, 3D imaging. So we are really not limited to any of the specific limiting imaging technologies. But in our lab, we listen to the customers. So let's say one breeder come to my lab and say, okay, we have this challenge. We really need to have an assessment of this genotype compared with the other genotypes, how this genotype can be more drought stress tolerating. So in order to help him or her, we try to understand what kind of the scenario this sensor is needed. So how to design a sensor to fit into that environment and help people to measure, to collect that signal. So that's what we do, from hardware design to software development.
That's fantastic. So one thing that I'm curious is, so on my research, I work with nitrogen stress sensing and management of that using the sensor data. And in my case, we use mostly multispectral sensors where we have 4 to 5 bands that we're looking into, right? And so, you know, you mentioned here a list of sensors you're using to detect these different stresses, and then hyperspectral is one that I think is really interesting to perhaps give us a better way of differentiating different stressors, right? Because normally with multispectral data, like what I use on my research, it's unless you have some checks and balances on the field, it's difficult to definitely diagnose what the stress is just with the sensory information, right? We normally can say, well, this part of the field is healthier than this or is more vigorous than this. But just using the sensor data, we cannot pinpoint what the stress is. Unless, again, is a study, we know what we are manipulating on the field, and therefore we know what's going on. But on the commercial scale, that's not the case, right? So my question, I guess, with all this this conversation is, has your team been able to use hyperspectral, perhaps other sensing technology, to be able to not only say this is healthier than this, but to say the reason, the diagnosis, just with the imaging data?
Yeah, so this is exactly what we're working towards. So as you pointed out, we use hyperspectral imaging technologies a lot to try to basically give a prediction or the classification, right? So talking about models, we have either the regression models to try to predict how much is the level of each different nutrient components, and then how severe is the diseases. But as you said, knowing how and knowing what kind of the imaging signal is associated with those symptoms, this is really, really important. Because technically, there is one big problem in plant phenotyping, which is basically overtraining. Sometimes it's really easy for a research group to develop a model and realize that the R-square of the regression and also the classification ratio for the classification type of the projects are really successful results. But it's very common that if you apply this very successful model from your greenhouse to another greenhouse, to another field, from one location, like transferring the model developed in Indiana and try to use that in Illinois and Iowa and Kansas, then they always meet with problems. The better case is that you only see some of the prediction drifts, but in the most of the cases, you see the worst results. The model just doesn't work at all. So the reason behind that is because of the overtraining, because most of the models we try to use, they actually utilize the variance in the data set to try to build the model. But the variance could be from all kinds of different reasons. It could be from the nitrogen treatment or water treatment or the genotype differences. But in agriculture, it's very complicated, right? The sunshine, the moisture, all kinds of the environmental conditions can cause variances. In the field and in the greenhouse, we have the microclimate issues. And the plants with the different status, growth status, they change a lot. And that is adding to the complexity. Not to mention that our study objective, the corn plants. These plants are very complicated themselves. They are the complicated three-dimensional canopy shapes. So we have the younger leaves on top, lower leaves at the bottom. So there is an aging gradient across the canopy body. And even looking at the same leaf, you know, when the leaf is growing, the tip parts are the older tissues, and then new tissues are pushing the leaf to grow forwards. So there is a very, very significant variance across a lot of the different dimensions. So that means it's very easy for our data set to contain all kinds of the variances. And if that's the modeling procedure is not controlled very well, they can be easily drifted and dominated by the other variances, giving you a good looking model, but not very good in practical tests. So I think I really agree with you that just getting the good model is just one step, right? But in order to really develop something which can benefit people, which people can trust and rely on and then sleep very well on those models, we need to really prove that we are seeing something. we need to explain why we say this is a high nitrogen. Nitrogen level is already high enough or not that enough, so you need to fertilize. We need to explain the reason. We need to really show you, this is the image, this is the texture, this is the color we see. So that is why we tell you about this nitrogen assessment. So being able to not only tell the result, but be able to also tell the reason, how we make that judgment is actually a totally different level. And if you can achieve that level, we can be much more confident to persuade people to adopt these technologies. So maybe I can, sometimes actually in our research group, we sometimes talk about the topic between so-called black box and so-called transparent box or white box, right? So many people have been trying to use, for example, multivariable modeling technologies like partial least squares modeling, neural network, deep learning models. So for those models, it's actually very difficult for human brain to understand what's the internal mechanism. So we don't know what is going on inside, but we just build the model as a black box. Looks like they can take the images as an input and output the nitrogen disease and chemical damage information, but we don't understand what's inside, and that's a very risky status and situation, because if you do not understand the internal mechanism, there is a huge risk of overtraining. So that is also why, personally, this is just my personal taste, that every time it's okay to use those black box models. If it works, it works, right? So if every time it successfully can give you the predicts the ground truth really well, then it works. But what I found over my last 15 years of the experience in plant phenotyping, my feeling is that if you can somehow change from the black box to the white or transparent box to know the mechanism inside, that can really help us to remove the noise, remove the disturbing side of the variances, and give us the simple but reliable models.
This is great. And so one thing that I think it's really key of your experience is that, you know, I mean, we're in academia, we're all doing research, a lot of people using sensors. As you said, a very common issue whenever we have, let's say, an image we're trying to associate with a stress is that we can create a model that works very well for that field, that year. But even on the same field, if you just go to the next growing season, the same model may fail completely, right? So just this problem of generalizability, there you go, of the model, it's something that, you know, in academia, it's something that we're definitely interested in. But with your background and your perspective, because now you have a company, right? Now you have a product that is just not, it's not just a paper that you're publishing, but it's actually a product you're selling. So that point is even more important to get right, right? So what have been some of the applications that you have seen of this complexity of having a lot of, you know, image and sensor data, trying to create models that can do a good prediction and that can generalize that prediction to other fields and years and sites that it has not seen before, right? So from the industry side, how, from the entrepreneurial side, how are you making sure that the models you train can generalize easily to other situations?
Yeah, I think simplification, and we also just mentioned the transparent box, easy to understand models. I think these are the two answers I would provide. So I can give you one example. So, you know, looking at the corn leaf, let's say we want to have an assessment of the nitrogen content. And now we are looking at this corn leaf, right? So looking at the image of the corn leaf, we basically need to make a decision how high the nitrogen content is. And usually, traditionally, people use NDVI or people use the green, any green index colors, because we know that the higher nitrogen it is, the higher chlorophyll content the leaf contains. So if the nitrogen is almost linearly correlated with nitrogen content, then we can simply use the greenness to assess that. But then we realize the opportunity because, for example, my company, LeafSpec, we produce a handheld hyperspectral scanner which can provide sub-millimeter spatial resolution with the real hyperspectral image. So combining that spectral resolution with hundreds of the color bands and the sub-millimeter spatial resolution, you can imagine we can see all the fine texture, the details. We can see the midrib, we can see the primary veins, sometimes even the secondary veins in the cone leaf. And we can see how the chlorophyll content is distributed between the base, the tip, the edge, the middle. So we can see all those details. So that variance used to be the noise if you just want to take a look at the whole leaf's greenness, right? But now this variance and the texture and the distribution is becoming a source of a signal to us. So how to find the very strong and characterize the pattern of the green distribution on the leaf. So we can use that to more robustly predict the nitrogen content. So that is still a challenge, and half of my lab is pushing onto this this whole leaf image and trying to explore in this three-dimensional space, you know, X, Y for spatial resolution and another lambda dimension for hyperspectral. So we are kind of swimming in this kind of the three-dimensional ocean to try to find at which location of the leaf and at this location with what kind of the color combination of the ratio we can calculate, and looking at the neighborhood, how big is the neighborhood of the leaf we should take a look, so we can find a unique texture or the distribution combined signal we can characterize, which is strongly correlated with nitrogen. So this is what we do. And one example is, for example, one of my PhD students in the former weeks, he is actually he's one of your colleagues. His name is Dr. Zhihang Song. So he just joined the University of Georgia last year. And his work is actually very impressive. So he basically swimmed in this three-dimensional space, and he found out that actually the texture between the primary vein and the intervenal area, that green versus yellow contrast, is a much, much better indicator of nitrogen content compared with the general leaves green color. So we even filed a patent, got the patent on that one. So the problem is, he also told me that actually that kind of the vein versus intervenal texture near the midrib of the leaf is even stronger in correlation with nitrogen. And also he could verify that with the large language models. You know, now ChatGPT is so popular, so of course we try those large language models on that. So again, he showed that near the neighborhood region of the midrib, we have the very strong nitrogen signal, which was never known before. But I was really not satisfied by just hearing, you know, the area of interest is either the tip or the edge or the midrib. But there is one question I always ask back. Okay, if you tell me this area is more important, show me on the original image. Can we see it? So I think if you want me to give just one sentence, the key sentence about how to make sure our model is effective or not, I would say that can we see it or not? If there is a real signal, of course we have advanced hyperspectral images which cannot be interpreted by the human eyes, because we only can understand three colors, and our human brain can only understand a three-dimensional space. We can understand, you know, multi-dimensional spaces, but still, based on my experience, if we really found a good signal, I still always believe in most of the cases, we should be able to see it with our eyes in the leaf, just to describe how this high nitrogen and low nitrogen leaves are looking, how they are looking differently on the leaves. If we can see it, very exciting. Let's believe it. Let's wrap it up as a new software and either commercialize or publish. But if we do not see it, probably it's worth spending some more time to dig deeper into that.
That's fantastic. So something you said that I thought was so well said was, you know, something that used to be noise, now you're turning that into signal, right? So in this case of the spatial resolution of the imaging that we get from the leaf, that is such an interesting point to think of. And I'll definitely be reflecting on that.
I have a comment on that. So I'm a huge fan of spatial resolution. I'm a phenotyping researcher and a phenotyping sensor engineer working on hyperspectral, multispectral images. But I'm a huge fan of spatial resolution. And in my personal opinion, over the last 20 years, you know, the phenotyping crop sensors have been developing very rapidly. But mostly people have been focused on spectral dimension, building all those spectral curve-based models. But I think the spatial resolution has been underutilized for phenotyping. And I see a huge potential working on that one. And my lab has been focused actually majorly on spatial resolutions to dig out new signals.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. Well, I think I have one more question for you here before we head out to our three last questions that we ask every guest. So the question I have for you is, how do you, because so the leaf spec, and you can correct me if I got this wrong, but leaf spec is a clip-on sensor, right? Meaning that you would go to a plant and, or maybe not clip-on, but you have to scan on the ground.
But it's not just looking at one spot. So actually that's the advantage of leaf spec. We do not just measure on one spot of the leaf, but we scan the whole leaf. It's kind of like the handheld document scanner.
Yeah.
Scan the leaf. The benefit is that we remove the ambient lighting noise. We keep the leaf really flat and comfortable. And then we got that very high spatial resolution and the spectral resolution together. So with all those high resolution, high quality images, that opens the door for discovering more novel disease and disease symptom signals and the nutrition signals.
Perfect. Well, thanks for expanding on how leaf spec works. And then the question I want to build on top of that is, at least the work that I do, although we do have ground sensors and drone sensors, but I always try to bring satellite imaging as well. So we test different sensors in different scales, especially because if something's going to be scalable, it's going to have to be through satellites, right? How do you envision that? Because, you know, so you're developing these sensing hardware, software technologies that are doing a great job right there when you are on the field with the sensor. Do you see a pathway to scaling that up to even maybe a drone or perhaps even a satellite level? Or how do you see this evolving?
Yeah. I think you are talking about the dilemma between two things. One is the speed, throughput. Another one is the quality. So sometimes we need to keep a good balance between these two things. So I think this is essentially the difference between remote sensing and proximal sensing, right? For remote sensing, the farther away you are from the plants, so you can fly the drone or the manned aircraft or the satellites, then it's so easy for you to scan the huge area within just hours or even just minutes. So the throughput is really high. It's really easy to use. And you can get the whole region of the data very quickly. But the problem is the further you are away from the plants, the resolution is lower. And then, you know, the atmosphere, the ambient lighting, then get into this game. And you got a lot of the noises, you get a lot of the disturbance. The environmental condition is more severe in this case. So that bothers, that hurts the quality of the imaging. And but if you get much closer and closer, then your resolution is higher. And even you get closer until you can touch it. Then you can control the environment and then use the chamber to block the ambient lighting, just like what LeafSpec is doing. So that's the opportunity. We realized that if we can touch the leaf, we can control a lot of the things. But as you pointed out, now the quality, there is a huge potential now for you to generate the much, much higher quality of the images, but the throughput is lower. So in my opinion, I think looking at the market, right? So we have been developing phenotyping sensors for so long, but so far it has been a game only for researchers. So the breeding companies, the university professors, we have been using these phenotyping sensors. But take a look at our agriculture market, our farmers. Some of the farmers, they still pay for some of the phenotyping tools, but they are just like playing a high-tech game. They use those images as a reference, but they never rely on those phenotyping sensor results for their fertilization, spraying, and watering decision-making. So that is very unfortunate. So we want to try to make it happen that someday our growers are really using these sensors to make those decisions. So now it's not happening. Why it's not happening? Because the remote sensing is not providing high enough quality for them to trust. The proximal sensors are too slow for them to use. So that is, but in my personal opinion, I think we need to probably solve the quality issue first. So if the quality is not meeting people's expectations, then people lose the confidence. That is not good for our industry. So let's show people that with our sensors, we can really see things. We can provide the good signals. So that's one of the reasons we switched from, I used to fly a lot of the drones and build hyperspectral, high throughput imaging towers, but now we miniaturize things and get them into touch-based sensors. So I hope we can show people the hope that, see, at least, although it's slow, it's handheld, it's leaf by leaf every time, but we can solve the quality issue first. And these are the signals, you know, looking at the submillimeter spatial resolution, we can see these are really correlated with nitrogen. You know, the tar spot looks like this. Northern blight disease, the dicamba versus 2,4-D, these two different herbicides actually show totally different sprayed leaves. So we show people that we are able to see the difference. That's the first step. And then if we can show people that the signals are really there, people can see it. Now it's a transparent or white box. People see the difference. Now they start to believe it. So next one is still our engineers should just work on it to make it even faster. So you talked about the scaling up. I think I have two answers to it. Number one is robotics and automation. So if you check my lab's website, actually I work a lot with the Purdue engineers to develop a lot of the ground-based robots, drone-based robots. So now we use those robots to replace human being to apply these proximal sensors to the field. They can fly automatically to any location, land, and use machine vision to find the targeted leaf, and use a robotic arm to capture the leaf, grasp the leaf, and scan fully automatically. And each measurement is georeferenced and time-stamped and uploaded to our GIS systems. So this kind of the ag IoT technologies, the robotic technologies to fully automate things, and we can have a fleet of robots working on that. So that can somehow relieve that throughput issue for proximal sensing. And another second idea is the data infrastructure. So how to utilize the GIS systems, the digital agriculture software systems, to leverage the multiple local measurement points and put combine them together so that you really do not need to walk to the every inch, every foot, square foot of the field, but with just the very smart choice of the several locations, you just get as many measurement locations, but just enough for you to get the idea to answer all your questions. Sometimes you really don't need to scan all the tens of thousands of the crops within 1 acre, right? If you want to understand the nitrogen contents, nitrogen could not suddenly change from this inch to that inch. There is a gradient. So how do you smartly sample on the grounds? And then, you know, I don't want to spend too much time, but one thing the data infrastructure, the smart map can do is if you can upload your measurement at every location on the real time, the map is growing the knowledge about the field while you are scanning. And then the map can also learn that, okay, I think I learned enough on the east side of the field, and looks like you have some issue on the west side of the field. I would really suggest you to scan more on those west locations. So the data infrastructure, the map system, can even tell our proximal sensors to know what is the next best location to go to scan. So we talk about high throughput phenotyping. I'm against to define the high throughput as how many samples we scan per minute. That's not throughput, that's the working intensity. But throughput should be defined as how much information, how much new information we collect for every minute. Scanning more doesn't give you more information if you are just repetitively scanning the same uniform crops again and again, then you are wasting your time. But going to those unknown locations, go to the best place to fill the gap on your gradient contour map to grow the knowledge of the field. That is called high throughput. So with that sense, I believe with proximal sensing, we can actually achieve very high throughput with robotics and data infrastructures.
That's amazing. Well, that was such a great explanation. We have done some of that with some of the work we do here to just do targeted sampling for different projects, different crops. But yeah, I totally agree with you, and I'm so glad you brought that up.
And can I very briefly share just one more sentence? So one last point is, I believe remote sensing is still also very, very important. So eventually, we still need the remote sensing technology to improve the throughput. So I think either some of the proximal sensing signals could be transferred to be implemented for remote sensing. Or I think sometimes the remote sensing and the proximal sensors should collaborate together. We can combine them as a solution. So you take an image of the whole region, and then you get the variance, the idea of the variance, and then you can send those proximal sensors to check some of the points of the locations to get the very detailed, accurate information, and then fuse the remote sensing and the proximal sensing together. So I foresee that could be the mode of the future to achieve high throughput and high accuracy at the same time.
That's fantastic. Kind of combining and complementing the strengths of each different system, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Perfect.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
All right. Well, with that, we're getting towards the latter part of our episode. Before we go to those three questions, I just want to quickly chat with our audience. If you're listening or viewing this episode and you're enjoying it, make sure to drop us a like, subscribe, follow us, and share with anyone else that you think may enjoy this great conversation with Dr. Jin. All right, Jin. So the last three questions of the episode, we ask them to every guest. The first one is, do you have any technical resource? So it could be from the agronomy side, from the phenotyping, the sensing, whatever it is on the technical side, but a resource that you have found to be useful for you that you could share with us.
Well, hopefully this is not a disappointing, but I think maybe it's because plant phenotyping is a very fast developing area. So I think the best resource is to keep updated with the outside world. You know, especially nowadays, the AI is really developing so fast. So ChatGPT, large language models, what does that mean to us, right? So I think my answer is just keep updated with all those new technologies. Keep learning, keep hungry, right? Well, but if there is a specific resource you would ask, I can say I would recommend everybody to find my research website at Purdue, and we do have a lot of the videos and the images and the pictures to show how Purdue engineers have been developing the advanced sensor technologies to solve some of the problems.
Absolutely. So just in case our audience is just listening to us, how could they, what should they Google to get to find your website?
Yeah, if you Google Jen Jing, my name, and with Purdue together, you should be able to find my website at Purdue. And then sometimes you may find my Purdue ABE website. And then on that website, there is a text said Sensor Lab website. So that contains more information.
Nice. Fantastic. All right. So our second question of the three is the same as far as a resource, but outside of the technical expertise. So do you have anything to recommend to our audience that is non-technical that you found useful for you?
Can I just recommend a movie?
Yeah, of course.
So my favorite movie is still the original Matrix.
Nice.
So I watched that movie when I was in my college during my sophomore year. So I was, you know, I was majored in computer science. So Matrix was, it touched a lot of the computer science disciplines, right? Oracle for database, and then virtual reality. Basically, Matrix is a virtual reality environment. So I love that movie. So I think the reason I recommend the movie is several points. Number one, relax yourself, watch some movies, right? So smell the rose. So that's for sure. But at the same time, I think this kind of the movie, it keeps people thinking, right? So after I watched Matrix, I was thinking, okay, where am I? Am I living in a real world, so-called real world? Or maybe last night, someone just covered my eyes and my skin and channeled in all the new information into me and controlled me today. So maybe I'm living in a Matrix today. How do I prove I'm actually in a real world or controlled by someone, bad guys or good guys for some reason? So I think my point is keep thinking, keep especially the critical thinking, doubt about things and find your own answers. So maybe that's another reason I recommend this movie. And that's really important for new innovations in our engineering discipline.
That's fantastic. I love that. I watched that movie, you know, it's been a while since I watched it, but definitely it's a good reminder that you know, old movies can have some really modern ideas and questions as well for us to think of. All right. So our last question of the three is, in your opinion, what are the skills or skill set that you have observed in successful professionals around you?
Yeah. So talking about my lab, we are working in plant phenotyping, but you don't see any major in any university called plant phenotyping. So our students are from all kinds of different training backgrounds, mechanical engineering, ECE, computer science, statistics. So I think learning those skills could take some time, but you can always learn by yourself. Whenever you need that skill, you can just take the class or just learn by yourself. That's always doable. But the most important thing, I think, is to keep the keep the passion on your research. So as long as you have the passion, you find the you know, the power for yourself to keep learning by yourself. So I think for what you want to do, those technical things, those things are, of course, very, very important. But make sure you find the thing you love and you see the value and you understand why what you are working on and how and why what you are working on can help other people's life, can make other people's life better. So as long as you get that skill to find the answer to these questions, it's not a problem for you to keep driving yourself.
Awesome. Absolutely. Thanks for sharing that. And well, with that, we wrap up today's episode. Jen, was great having you here today. I really, really enjoyed our conversation, especially because, you know, I work with in some similar topics. So I was really excited to learn from you and from your experience as well. So thanks for being with us today, sharing all these great information. It was great having you here.
Yeah, same here. It's great talking with you today.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.